tablet, so I'm not going to be able to plug in and show anything on the screen. So those of you that are at home watching this in the live stream or after the fact, I apologize. I was distracted this morning by different things, and I forgot to pack my tablet into my church bag, and so it is what it is, I suppose. I was able to print a hard copy of the notes, so I should be all set for the regular church service, but I don't have the tablet, so I'm not going to be able to show you some of the stuff that we're going to be talking about. So we might get through the notes today a little bit quicker than normal. Eli, when we're done in here, we're going to have to remember to shut the stream off at the computer in the main auditorium, because normally you've got to go into YouTube and end it. And I normally do it right here from the tablet at the end, so we're going to have to remember to do that.
Okay.
So anyway, I apologize for forgetting that, and we're just going to have to make do with what we've got in the notes. That is going to impact a little bit what I'm able to show you. I normally like to show stuff on the screen. This time I'm going to kind of have to talk about it, and you guys will have to kind of go back and look at it yourself. If you're joining us right now on the live stream and you do want to follow the notes, you can go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, scroll down under recent sermons. There should be an entry for today, Sunday, May 12th, and you should be able to find the link to lesson 234. Before we get too far in, I also just want to say Happy Mother's Day to all the moms here. It's important to acknowledge and recognize that. And we will be going off of the printed notes. So again, I apologize for forgetting the tablet. Walked in here, went to my bag, didn't have it, and I'm like, perfect. So anyway. All right, lesson 234, let's get started. Assessing the printed history of the King James text. We're going to be talking specifically today, starting to at least, the 1629 Cambridge edition. All right. So let's get into the introduction. Again, if you're at home following along, you're going to want to go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, click on the link for May 12th, and then you should be able to find the notes by clicking that. Okay. Lesson 234, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text, 1629 Cambridge edition. Introduction. In lesson 229, so that's a few lessons ago, we began a study aimed at assessing the printed history of the King James text. So we did that back in lesson 229. More recently, for those of you that are live, we have a service dog in the room today that you might have just heard whining a little bit there. Apparently the service dog would like to eat the notes. Do with that what you want. More recently, in lesson 233, we concluded our look at the activity of the king's printer, Robert Barker. I think that should say, should that be an apostrophe or a possessive S there on King's printer? Not sure. I might need to check that.
No.
Look at the activity of the King's printer, Robert Barker, between 1611 and 1617. So we did that now. In doing so, we concluded the following. We concluded with the following summative statement from the pen of Professor David Norton. All right. We saw, quote, the King's printer, in various combinations of Barker, Norton, and Bill, printed many more editions, but there is no more work of textual significance to note. By 1617, their text had reached some sort of stasis, if not uniformity. Just as sheets of different editions were mixed, so too were readings. It is a tale of commercial enterprise that was not always competent, tempered with some limited scholarly attention to the text. The incompetence reached its apotheosis in the notorious Wicked Bible, a 1631 octavo that admits not from the seventh commandments. We talked about the Wicked Bible, right? It reads, thou shalt commit adultery. They don't have the not in the verse, okay? The error may possibly have been sabotage. Herbert suggests, quote, on the part of a partisan of Norton to discredit the Barkers. So there's some suggestion that it was intentional. That if you guys remember, there was a legal dispute between Barker, Norton, and Bill over who had the rights to print, and there was a lot of intrigue and controversy going on. And there is some reason to suggest that one of those three may have intentionally printed one edition without the word not as a way of discrediting one of the partners, okay, that had the primary patent to print. So that's speculation. We should be honest about that. That's speculation. I don't know if you can prove that, but it is an interesting idea to consider, okay? If so, it is eloquent. If so, it is eloquent of the personal tensions and shortcomings that contributed to many mysteries in the early texts of the King James Bible, okay? So I don't want you to have the impression that when we stopped at 1617 and now we're jumping to 1629, that there weren't other editions published in that intermittent little decade or more, because there were, but they were basically static editions of the ones that were coming off the presses of Norton, Barker, or Bill at that time. So in other words, the text had sort of stabilized into a form, and for the time period between 1617 and 1629, there were relatively few changes that were being made during that decade or so's worth of time. Okay. Now, prudence dictates that we now turn our attention to the two major editions published by Cambridge University Press in 1629 and 1638. These are two pretty significant editions in the level of editorial work and changes, spelling, you know, different things that are going on in the editions that are edited by and printed by Cambridge University Press in 1629 and 1638. These editions did much to standardize and stabilize the text of the AV throughout the rest of the 17th century and the first half of the 18th century. So after 1638, you're basically going to go pretty much all the way to about 1762 before there's really anything else done to the text. Now, that does not mean that there are not intermittent instances where a printer in Edinburgh or a printer somewhere else would, you know, inadvertently make a mistake or make a change, or that something was done to the text. But generally speaking, after 1638, not a lot is done to it until 1762 and then again in 1769, okay? So in order to accomplish this task, we will use chapter 5 of David Norton's book, A Textual History of the King James Bible, titled Correcting the Text, 1629 to 1760, to frame the discussion. In this lesson, we will cover the following points. So today we're basically going to look at two things, right? First, a brief history of Cambridge University printing rights. And second, we'll start looking at the 1629 Cambridge edition, all right? Any questions about the introduction? All right. So, a brief history of Cambridge University printing rights is the first major point for this lesson. The history of Cambridge University Press as a crown-sanctioned printer goes all the way back to the reign of Henry VIII in the year 1534. Okay? In his history of the university's press titled Cambridge University Press, 1534 to 1984, author Michael Black states the following quote, Letters patent of Henry VIII on the 20 July 1534 gave license to the chancellor, masters, and scholars to appoint printers as well as stationers. All right, if you go to top page 2, this is a surviving copy of that declaration. You will notice, and this is where I wish I had remembered my tablet because I could show this on the screen, which I'm not able to do today because I forgot it. But you can see there that this is thoroughly worn now. This document has suffered significant wear over the years, but this is a copy of that from the original issuing. All right. Now, if you look at the first point on page 2, originally written in Latin, you can see that in the image above, Black provides an English translation which states in part, quote, assigned, appointed, and in perpetuity have among them three stationers and printers or sellers of books have lawful and incontestable power to print there all manner of books approved or hereafter to be approved by the aforesaid chancellor or his deputy and three doctors there. So that's a portion of what that document says. So So is it granting Cambridge University Press Crown authority to print and to publish certain documents? Okay, that is the point. Professor David Norton cites W.W. Gregg's work, a companion to Arbor, being a calendar of documents in Edward Arbor's Transcript of Registers of the Company of Stationers of London, 1554 to 1640, in support of the following statement, quote, in keeping with this charter, John Leggett, the second of the university's printers, ventured into Bible printing in the 1590s. Okay? So the Cambridge University patent to print dates from 1534, when King Henry VIII ascribes printing rights to the university. All right? So you go a number of years from 1534 into the 1590s before the Cambridge University Press wades into the issue of Bible printing and they print a biblical text. Okay? Bottom of page 2. A.S. Herbert's Historical Catalog of Printed Editions of the English Bible, 1525 to 1961, contains the following entries for these Cambridge printings. So the first one, he dates 1590 with a question mark. All right? And this is a Geneva Thompson New Testament. So if you remember back to when we studied the Geneva Bible, you hopefully will recall that there was a later revision of the Geneva Bible, of certain parts of it, done by a guy named Thompson, I've seen it spelled different ways. Okay? And this first edition of the Cambridge University Press that Herbert lists 1590 question mark is a Geneva Thompson New Testament. Go to page 3. Quoting from the catalog, the Cambridge University Library in Early English Printed Books, number 5544, style, dates this edition 1593, but the BM catalog assigns it to 1590. So there's some discrepancy about whether this was a 1590 or a 1593, but it's right there within that roughly 3-year time period that Cambridge University Press is printing a Geneva New Testament. Okay? Then if you look at the next entry from Herbert's catalog, it says 1591, and this is a Geneva Bible, or this is a complete Bible, Old and New Testament. Alright? And Herbert says following about it, in part, he says, apparently, the earliest edition of the English Bible printed at Cambridge. So, Cambridge University Press gets crown authority in 1534 to print. They do not print any Bibles until the 1590s. In the 1590s, they print a New Testament edition, and then they print an entire edition or entire Bible of the Geneva Bible. Those are the first forays of the university press into the printing of Bibles. Okay? Now we'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions?
Is there any reason that they would wait a few years?
It's a great question. I don't know the answer why they waited so long. I'm not totally sure as to why that would be the case. Anything I would say to answer that, Bart, would just be total speculation. Nothing that I read and prepped for this really said why they waited so long. They were printing a bunch of other stuff, but it's unclear to me why they waited so long to print a Bible. Okay? But it seems that they don't, once they start, they're not really dabbling in that a ton until a little bit later. Okay? So the earliest documentable interest in Cambridge University printing the authorized version of the King James Bible dates from November 1623. Okay? Now I say, earliest documentable. Possibly there was earlier interest that the university had in printing the King James text, but this is the first clear documentable evidence that exists of them expressing interest in doing this. So let's just stop there for a minute. The King James is first printed in 1611. The first documentable evidence of interest in Cambridge University Press to print the King James text is from 1623. So it's from 12 years after the text began to be printed by the King's printer, Robert Barker. Okay? So if you look at that point again, the earliest documentable interest in Cambridge University Press printing the AV dates from November 1623. As Professor Norton suggests, this request from 1623 implies, okay, that earlier undocumented petitions of the Crown to publish the text might have been filed. So we can't rule out that they maybe did petition sooner than this, but we can't prove it through a documented source. Okay? In other words, he's going to suggest a couple reasons why possibly they might have been interested in this sooner, but we'll hold off on that until we get to those points. Okay? So he says, quote, in November 1623, the Vice Chancellor of Cambridge was, quote, willing to forego the printing of the Bible in 8, that would be octavo size, and be content with 4, that would be quarto size, okay, and 12. Though this is the earliest surviving reference to the university wanting to print the King James Bible, it implies earlier suits by its appearance of offering a compromise. So, understand what Norton's saying. In this documentable evidence, Cambridge is saying, alright, we will forego printing in octavo, but we want to print it in quarto, and what Norton is suggesting is that this appears to be a compromise, right? The nature of the compromise suggests potentially that there were prior filings for permission to print, more than just a quarto or a 12. You follow what I'm saying? Or what that? So, yes, Norton is speculating. He is making something of an educated guess based upon the nature of the earliest surviving documentable source of Cambridge petitioning to print the King James Press. Remember, guys, could any Tom, Dick, or Harry just print this? No. The Crown had custodial authority over the text, right? There was a cum privilegio, it was vested in the Crown. The Crown had custodial authority over the text, and only Crown-approved printers could print the text legally. All right. So, next point. Norton and Gregg document that this 1623 request was rejected by the Privy Council, thereby forbidding Cambridge University Press from printing the text. Quote, the initial response was totally discouraging. In December, the Privy Council forbade printing of the Bible by the university printer. And that's documented in Gregg, page 65 and 185. And there seems to have been no sign of a different attitude until the original charter by Henry VIII was confirmed in February 1628. So the earliest documentable petition for Cambridge is in 1623. It is clearly not granted at that time. In 1628, the original charter of Henry VIII to Cambridge University is re-upped, in other words, by the Crown. All right, this seems to have changed the Crown's opinion about whether they were going to allow Cambridge to print the authorized version. Look at the next point. The fact that Cambridge was able to print an edition in 1629, the same year it was granted printing rights, suggests that editorial work on the project began prior to 1629. Okay? So, understand what is being said there. In 1623, do they petition the Crown and are they shut down? Okay? In 1628, the Crown re-ups the original sort of proclamation of Henry VIII from 1534. Now it's 1628. Cambridge prints a text in 1629. So the suggestion is that the changes that are going to be made in the 1629 had to have been being made for some time. In other words, this was a project that was being worked on for some time prior to 1629. Does everybody understand that point? Anybody got any questions?
So the Geneva was the first English Bible?
No.
No?
The first English Bible printed was a Tyndale New Testament. It was not printed in England. It was printed on the continent and smuggled into England because it was illegal. The first full English Bible, Old and New Testament to be printed is the Coverdale Bible in 1535. Okay? What we're talking about right now is only Cambridge University's history of printing. Okay? They first print Bibles in the 1590s, a Geneva New Testament and a complete Geneva Bible. Now, in the 1620s, they're trying to get permission from the Crown to print the Authorized Version, or the King James Bible. In 1623, they are denied rights. In 1628, the Crown re-ups the original print patent of Henry VIII from 1534, and then in 1629, the next year, Cambridge University Press prints the Authorized Version text. What Norton is saying is that when you look at the level of changes, which we'll get into here in a minute, that were done to the Cambridge text of 1629, it suggests that that was a project the university had been working on for some time prior to when they finally published it in 1629. Does that make sense? Okay. So, bottom of page 3. The fact that Cambridge was able to print an edition in 1629, the same year that it was granted printing rights, suggests that editorial work on the project began prior to 1629. Professor Norton posits the following explanation. Quote, "As will be evident, a great deal of work, including a complete examination of the King James Bible against the original languages." So there's very clear evidence that the Cambridge printing of 1629 compared the English text of the King James with the Greek and the Hebrew. Okay? They did what Norton would call a scholarly examination, where they're comparing the English against the Greek and the Hebrew. Okay? So let's start over again with that quote. "As will be evident, a great deal of work, including a complete examination of the King James Bible against the originals, went into the first Cambridge edition of 1629. Perhaps," so he's speculating, "there was time for it in the 14 months from February 1628 to April 1629. But it seems more likely that the work began before the end of 1623. Okay? So let's understand what he's saying. The Crown re-upped the Cambridge University patent in 1628. In April 1629, they print the AV for the first time. That's 14 months. Okay? But remember, had they petitioned way back in 1623 for permission to do this? So Norton is saying, when you look at the depth of the examination that occurred, he's suggesting that while it could have been done in 14 months, it's unlikely that it was. It probably needed more time, and the university possibly knew that it wanted to make certain of these changes way back in 1623 when they originally petitioned for authority to do so. Is everybody understanding the argument here? Okay. "Scholarly attention to the dissatisfaction with the King's printer's work may have been an earlier date that would ordinarily be inferred from the appearance of the Cambridge edition in 1629. Now, again, Norton is speculating there to some degree, but he seems to me to be making potentially some very good educated guesses. The university obviously had an interest in printing this way before 1629, when they actually finally do print it. Okay? Any questions before we move on? So before moving on to discuss the 1629 Cambridge edition specifically, Norton offers the following additional remarks. Top page 4. Quote, "Another motive probably contributed to the quality of the Bible issued by Thomas and Buck, printers to the University of Cambridge. Cambridge was making a claim to printing and editorial quality beyond anything their London rivals could produce." So let's stop there. Is the Cambridge University Press saying that we will produce a superior product to the King's printer? That's what they're saying. They will have better print conditions. They will have better control over the text. There will be fewer errors and fewer mistakes. The Cambridge University Press seems to be making this kind of a claim. that they will be putting out superior editions to what the King's printer had heretofore been printing. Okay? Let's start over. Another motive probably contributed to the quality of the Bible issued by Thomas and John Buck, so they're brothers, okay? Printers to the University of Cambridge. Cambridge was making a claim to printing and editorial quality beyond anything their London rivals could produce. So do we already know that there were major inconsistencies in the way the King's printer was operating, as far as changes being made in editions and all that sort of thing? We've studied that already in some detail, right? Part of this implicit claim was embodied in its conspicuously modern appearance. Roman type by itself was nothing new, but the use of the UVJ and occasionally apostrophes was. So let's stop there. So by 1629, is there a clear advancement in orthography and how you're going to spell some of these words with changes in U, V, and J and the apostrophe as possessive? Okay? So the Cambridge University Press is saying, we can print the text better than the King's printer through the use of some of these actual printing techniques. I'll say it that way for lack of a better way of saying it. There was much commercial sense in establishing such claims, and one other aspect of this Bible shows both commercial intent and a better managed printing house than Barker's. It was printed on 7 different qualities of paper. Okay? Now, why would they do that?
Prices.
The higher the quality paper, the more expensive the volume is going to be. Right? So, the Cambridge University Press is able to print the text on 7 different qualities of paper. Okay? Let's see. There was much commercial sense in establishing such claims, and one other aspect of the Bible shows commercial intent and a better managed printing house than Barker's. It was printed on 7 different qualities of paper, so catering for a diverse market, and incidentally offering quite different senses of its quality as an artifact according to whether one examines an edition on the best or on the worst one paper. Okay? So there are reasons to suggest that the Cambridge University Press is going to be producing a superior product to anything the King's printer. And I would say there are essentially 3 reasons. Number 1, is Cambridge subjecting the text to a scholarly review, the English text against the Hebrew and Greek? That's number 1. Number 2, do they have better techniques as far as letter formation and possessive cases in what they can print? And are they printing on 7 different qualities of paper to provide for 7 different price levels of this? So obviously, theoretically, the higher the quality paper, the more the volume would cost. The lower the quality paper, the expense would go down accordingly. Okay? So therefore, are they going to vary the market with different levels of quality so that more people can theoretically buy one at the level of quality they can afford? Okay? Now, before we move on, does anybody have any questions?
Did they really have editorial license to change anything?
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, it sounded like they were going to check the text and bring it.
So they are definitely checking the text on issues of spelling, on issues of...
But just spelling, but not real changes.
They're not making like wholesale substantive changes.
Okay.
But they are taking the English text and comparing it for spelling reasons, for other purposes. And they seem to have... And I would say that given the inconsistencies of the King's printer, most people would have viewed this as a good thing. That Cambridge University Press was entering into this market and that they were going to do so at a higher level of thoroughness.
And make it a little more easy to read for the standard.
and make it easier to read in spelling, make it easier to read in typesetting, make it more widely available in terms of variety of prices.
Now, the other question I had was there any evidence of corruption in the, if they were already authorized to print the edition, but they were denied it, was there a political or a monetary?
I think it would have been political in the sense of, does the King's Printer want Cambridge University Press to enter this market on the AV? I would say no, they don't.
Yeah.
Right? So while the Cambridge University Press had print authority, there does seem to have been, they at least felt that they needed to petition the Privy Council for printing rights.
So is that like a bureaucratic?
That's an official Crown authorized channel to grant them authority, to custodial authority to print the text.
So it's sort of like a code violation. You gotta meet the code.
Yeah, I mean, people don't understand it. Modern Americans, I think, struggle to understand this concept, right? Because the King James text in America is in the public domain, right? But even today, in England, in areas under the Crown's jurisdiction, it is not. Cambridge University Press, if you go to their website, still to this day, talks about how they have print authority from the Crown to publish the King James text. And it's clear to me that they do take that with a high level of seriousness. Okay, and even today, you know, Cambridge offers, you know, a variety of different sizes, different editions. You could get certain editions with or without the Apocrypha. They definitely are taking seriously their custodial authority to print the text. So. My Bible, I'm in Oxford. This is a Schofield Reference Bible. Oxford also had, at a point, was grand authority to print too. And so then you've got the war between the two great British universities, right? Oxford and Cambridge. Any other questions?
You know, the other Bibles that were being printed, like for the Catholics, was that all undercover?
No.
Because that wasn't it illegal?
So the Douay-Rheims Bible was being printed.
Yeah, that was the Netherlands, right?
No, I think there were, well, I'm going to caveat this. I'm pretty sure that there were British presses on the motherland printing the Douay-Rheims. Could be wrong. Maybe if they were printed anywhere, they would have been printed in France, Catholic France. The Geneva Bible was being printed in Amsterdam and other places by this point. Okay? Any other questions? All right, then let's start talking about the 1629 Cambridge. We're not going to finish this, so we'll kind of get as far into this as we can. Okay? I wasn't planning on saying everything there was to say about this anyway. I figured it would take two lessons even before I made a bonehead move and forgot my tablet. Okay? So, the 1629 Cambridge edition. In the previous section, we noted Professor Norton's statement that, quote, a great deal of work, including a complete examination of the King James Bible against the original languages, went into the first Cambridge edition of 1629. Norton explains the scope of the change as follows. Changes? Should that be plural? The scope of the changes probably, I think, is better. So here's the first quote, okay? The editors made more changes to the text than any other set of editors. Okay? Now, he would say, that is Norton, that is a factual statement proved by data of changes. Okay? By my count, counts of this sort always have an element of roughness, so he's acknowledging that this stuff's sort of hard to count, so he's acknowledging there's an element of roughness to this. They introduced 221 readings, of which 199 became standard. So what he's saying there is the 1629 Cambridge edition introduced 222 readings that were different from prior editions, and that 199 of these 221 became the standard readings. So they would be readings that you would still have in your 1769 that you have in the table in front of you. You follow that? Okay? In terms of frequency, this is roughly one new reading every five chapters. They also confirmed a further 59 variants from the first edition found in some of the earlier editions. The spelling of names is largely, but not entirely, a scholarly matter. They introduced 178 spellings, of which 157 have become standard, and they confirmed a further 34 spellings. Okay? Overall, 493 changes were made, of which 447, 91%, became standard. You guys following those numbers? Any questions? Go to page 5. Footnote 7 from chapter 5, or for chapter 5, lists all the readings that became standard because of the 1629 Cambridge edition. Okay? As well as the rejected readings, please consider the following screenshot from pages 84 and 85 of Norton's book. So this is where I wish I had my tablet, because I would project this and we would sort of highlight or accent a couple of these for the benefit of those who are watching online. But what you have here is a screenshot of footnote number 7. Okay, so let's read it. This and the following notes list references for the readings. The readings themselves can be found in the table of variants in Appendix 8. Okay, standard readings. So all of those readings that are listed there, starting with Genesis 6:5 and ending with Revelation 21:20, became standard edition King James readings through the work of the 1629 Cambridge edition. So that quite a few readings. Okay? Then there's rejected readings listed in the next section, beginning with Exodus 22:23 and ending in 1 Timothy 4:16. Okay? So just right there, if we took that entire list and we got a 1611 and we got a 1629 and we got a 1769, could we compare where it started in 1611, where it was in 1629, and if it still is the standard reading of 1769. Okay? Now, that alone, if you did that for every single one of those, that would probably take 3 or 4 classes. Right? I mean, it would take a long time to look at every one of those verses and do so with the appropriate level of thoroughness. So what I have elected to do is give you guys in class, the pertinent information where you could do this if you wanted to do it. Now, if I had had the tablet, we probably would have picked maybe 2 or 3, and we still might do this next time, now, because I forgot the tablet, and just show you how this works for maybe 2 or 3 of these. Okay, and we still might do that, but I'm not able to do that now because I can't project it and show it. So, you can see though the level of what's going on here with the 1629 Cambridge. All these numbers, man, you start talking about this stuff and they get all jumbled up real quick, okay? So you can see the level there. Let's go to the next bullet on that page. Footnote 8 on page 84 lists 59 confirmed variants from the first edition found in some of the earlier editions. And so you have another 59 confirmed readings, starting with Genesis 22:7 and ending with 2 Timothy 4:13. Okay? So again, you can do the same exercise. You can take a 1611, you can take a 1629, you can take a 1769, and you could compare these things out and see, you know, what's happening with these different readings. Okay? Page 6. On the same page, so that would be page 84, on the same page, footnote 9 lists the spelling data for standard, rejected, and confirmed spellings. All right? So let's look at footnote 9. It's on page 6. In these lists, subsequent references where the same change is made are given in brackets following the first occurrence. So then the first section is standard spellings. The second section is rejected spellings. And then the third section at the bottom is confirmed spellings. Does everybody see how that footnote works? Okay? And then if you go to the bottom of page 6, Professor Norton concludes this section on spelling changes and standardization in the 1629 Cambridge edition by stating the following. Okay? Quote, the changes to names are generally straightforward and show clearly the kind of care the 1629 editors brought to their work. The translators had been instructed that, quote, the names of the prophets and the holy writers with the other names in the text were to be retained as nearly as may be according as they are vulgarly used, and that was rule number 2. Okay? Usage was to override scholarly or pedantic respelling. The names were to be translated rather than transliterated. Okay? Though the translators perhaps did not sin greatly against vulgar usage, their treatment of names was inconsistent and probably not helped by their printers. Okay? Now, here's an example from Judith. Olafrens? Is that how you would say that?
Yeah.
Olafrens and Holafrens. So, the one has an H in front and that's not in the other one. In Judith, sufficiently indicates their shortcomings in this matter. The 1629 edition editors evidently decided to try for consistency, and they judge the less common names, arguably those with vulgar usage, was less applicable if they attended to the translator's rule, should be transliterated as part of an effort to make the translation more literal and scholarly. So that's why, the way I understand that, okay, is why when you come to, let me see if I can find a quick example of this. Go to let's see here. I think we could go to Matthew. Go to Matthew chapter 3. So, I have to confess that I think that Norton is possibly speculating slightly here. But let me show you what I believe him to be talking about in that statement. Matthew chapter 3, look at verse 1. In those days came John the Baptist preaching in the wilderness of Judea and saying, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. But look at verse 3. For this is he that was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. Okay? Notice Isaiah. Who is that?
Isaiah.
But how's it spelled? It's spelled as a transliteration. It's a transliteration. It's not a spelling of Isaiah's name. It's a transliteration. It's not a translation. If it were a translation, it would say what? Isaiah. But it's spelled this way as a transliteration, right? So if you go back to the notes, look at the last sentence on the top paragraph of page 7, okay? The 1629 editors evidently decided to try for consistency, and they judge that the less common names, arguably those with vulgar usage, was least applicable if they attended to the translator's rule, should be transliterated as part of an effort to make the translation more literal and scholarly. Okay, so instead of translating that and saying Isaiah, it's transliterated to say what? Isaiah. And what Norton is saying is that the 1629 Cambridge standardized a lot of this type of thing in the King James text. But that's one example of what he's talking about. Okay? Bud, you look puzzled.
Well, I'm just thinking then to say Isaiah was the vulgar usage, and that's just the way they pronounced it, but it wasn't scholarly or proper. And so in most cases, it is the vulgar usage that we see. And maybe they might have put Isaiah everywhere where we see Isaiah now. It should have been at that time.
So that would go back quick to page 6 and look at the last start. Let's see, the word "the" 4 lines from the bottom with a quotation mark in front of it. The names of the prophets. So this is the what rule 2 said. Okay, the names of the prophets and the holy writers, with the other names in the text, were to be retained as near as may be accordingly as they were vulgarly used. When I read that, what that says to me is that they should have said Isaiah, not Isaias. Does anyone read that different? Maybe I'm not understanding the tenet of rule 2.
Keep it vulgar.
Vulgar to me would be the, you know, not vulgar here, but obviously doesn't mean cursing. It means common.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. What Norton then seems to be suggesting on page 7 is that when the 1629 editors were working on this, that they opted for transliterations on purpose to make it more an element of consistency, yes, but also more literal. It's more literal to transliterate than it is to translate, and to give it more of a scholarly sound. Now, we could debate that probably for the next 10 weeks, and I could probably have 10 new enemies on social media before the end of this class. Just reporting what seems to be the case, okay? They begin with the translator's inconsistent treatment of 2 of Noah's sons, okay? Bob 1602's Shem, without the H, is left unannotated until Genesis 9:18. So what they're saying there is, in Bob 1602, the earlier occurrences of Shem are not annotated until you get to the occurrence in Genesis 9:18, where H begins to be inserted, giving what is now the vulgar usage Shem. The 1629 editors regularized the earlier instances of Shem without the H to Shem with the H, upholding the translator's later decision and conforming to the Hebrew, this is Japheth, I believe, right? The 1602 spelling is followed initially by the translators, then beginning from Genesis 9:23, the H is deleted. The first edition, however, gives Japheth with the PH from verse 18 on. Here, the 1629 editors regularize the first form of Japheth, the way we now understand it to be spelled, arguably the better representation there of the Hebrew. So that's the kind of stuff they're doing. They're standardizing these spellings because the earlier editions were inconsistent in how they would spell the same names of the same people. Does that make sense? Yes, no, maybe so? Okay. Next, they begin their regularization of another of the translator's inconsistencies, changing Chaldees without the H to Chaldees with the H at Genesis 15:7. The translators had already let Chaldees stand in 11:31. So, in other words, is the same word spelled inconsistently in the 1611 to refer to the same thing? That's what that's saying, right? But here, they deleted the H in Bod 1602. Later in the chapter 5, verse 19, I'm assuming that's what that's referring to, the translators amended the 1602's Tenizzites to, so the change there is, there's two E's, it's K-E-N-E, right? And then they spell it later on, K-E-N-I. Does everybody see that? Okay? Here the annotation about 1602 is unclear. The 1629 editors, noting that the, I'm going to assume that's Hebrew, right?
Yeah,
Zane. Zane is doubled in the Hebrew, further amend to Kezanites, K-E-N-I, two Z's. Okay? Notice the original spellings only had how many Z's? One. Okay? Now, the last two changes make no difference to the sound of the names. Nearly one-third of the spellings are of this sort, enhancing the scholarly purity of the text, but one might suggest making no practical difference to the reading. So in other words, does it matter if you spell that word with two Z's or one Z? No. Is it technically probably more accurate to spell it with the two Z's when compared to the Hebrew? Yes, but is there a substantive difference in meaning between spelling it with one Z and two Z's? No. Okay? And so the work goes on. Almost always increasing consistency and orthographical correctness. Total consistency is not achieved, and occasionally the editors appear to make mistakes. For example, Abida, for the translators correct Abida, Genesis 25:4, or the opposite error, Jahaz, right? So I would say that, for Jahaz in Joshua 13:18. Even so, acceptance of 88% of their changes to the names shows how accurately they worked. It also shows that later editors agreed with the principles on which they worked. The result is that even if the spellings did not represent vulgar usage in their time, through long acceptance, they have become the spelling vulgarly used. So in other words, because the King James text spelled them this way, were they then adopted into standard English spelling the way they were spelled in the AV? Okay? So I know that was a lot, so let's just end with this point. In the next lesson, we'll continue our look at the 1629 Cambridge edition by considering some additional points of interest. But those are some examples, guys, there on page 7 of the types of things that you'll find if you look at all of the, if you look at footnote 7, footnote 8, and footnote 9 from pages 5 and 6. Okay? So, now, as I said probably 4 or 5 times already, if I hadn't forgotten the tablet, I would have projected some of this and showed you what I'm talking about. Okay? But unfortunately, I forgot it. So, does anybody have any questions or comments about this? Next Sunday, we will say a few more things about the 1629. So, is the Cambridge 1629 a very important edition in terms of standardizing spellings and these kinds of things? It's absolutely an important edition when it comes to some of this stuff. And they did a good job, and 88% of their changes become standard changes then throughout the rest of the printed editions of the King James. So, does anybody have any questions or comments about the lesson?
How did they link that? Okay, the Cambridge makes the change, and then like another printer says, you know, how did they find out? I mean,
I think they would have had to be referencing the Cambridge printing. Would be to me the only way that you would.
Because if the Cambridge became standard, then for everyone else. And everyone else had to, I mean, like, when the Cambridge came out hot off the press, did everyone want to, oh, hey, let's get one to compare to ours?
I would say that, well, first of all, we got to clarify everyone. Everyone in this case is a small number of people. It would be Cambridge University Press and the King's Printer.
Okay?
At that time. That's it. There's, you know, know, Joe Schmo around the corner isn't printing this. It's only Crown printers with custodial authority. So what I think happens is over time it becomes understood that the Cambridge printing is superior to what the King's printer is doing. And so without some royal decree or proclamation, people just understand that the Cambridge product is better, and so it just sort of becomes the standard that is going to be used then going forward. I would surmise that the King's printer in 1629, the Cambridge press rolls off however many editions they make in April 1629. I would think that the King's printer still has unused sheets of old printings that he's probably going to want to use and get rid of before he might start moving to some of these more standard Cambridge readings. I'm guessing, I'm surmising that. That seems to me to make sense, because I don't think he's going to want to waste whatever he's got already printed, given the costs of doing all of this. Okay? Anything else?
When these Bibles started to be printed in America, I guess 1782, around there, were they just duplicates of the Cambridge edition?
Yeah, they were. They would take whatever Bible they had, probably from a standard 1769, and then they would start typesetting the print. In the early 1800s,
what's the name of it?
Stereotyping? I think it's called stereotyping becomes a thing, where what they would do is they would typeset something, and then they would make a plaster cast of the page. So then, from then on, they had a whole page where they could then just stack the plaster cast, the stereotype pages. So you start seeing in the early 1800s about, I'm going to say somewhere between 1810 and 1820, Bibles starting to be printed, especially by the American Bible Society, King James Bibles, where it will say on the frontest page or on the title page, stereotyped. When you see stereotyped, that's what it's referring to. It's referring to the new printing technology where they would lay the page out and then they would make a plaster cast of it, so they now they have a page. And so then they would run those for as long as they could until those wore out.
So they would print them with plaster?
So then they would make a plaster cast.
Or, yeah. So instead of having like metal individual little things, your page is all done.
Yep.
You didn't have to keep
redoing it. That was a new technology in the early 1800s in printing. Now that had limitations too, because if you made a mistake and you've cast the page, you know, now if you run a million copies of that page, you have a million copies with that mistake on it. So so on the one hand, that made things cheaper and faster, but on the other hand, you know, then you're kind of stuck with whatever you've got on that cast.
Do any of those exist?
What?
Those plaster ones?
That's a great question. I don't know. I'm sure there's a Bible museum somewhere in the United States that has old plaster castings of Bible pages. I'm sure that exists. Bud, you might know. You guys with the antique market, you might know that. I don't know. But before that, there's an American printer, Mike, to answer your question. His last name is Carey. Collins or Carey. There's two guys. I get them confused sometimes. And this guy had a warehouse, and he kept trays of standing type for every page of the Bible. Now imagine that. Imagine keeping trays organized in order of standing type to print every page of the Bible. The amount of money that he has tied up into the print characters and into all this stuff is just insane to think about. Like, I don't even know what the numbers are, but like, that's what was going on. when Americans first started printing the text. And as I said last Sunday, and as I argued in my book, The King James Bible in America, very early in the 1790s, American printers were Americanizing spelling. Good, bad, right, wrong, or indifferent, you can get mad about it, you cannot like it, but that is a reality. So are we going to adopt a position on the King James that says all these American printings are illegitimate because they spelled certain words differently than the British printings did? I'm not willing to take that position. Okay? I'm just not. Because that means that all of our forebears, all of our American forebears that accepted the King James Bible printed on American presses as the Word of God, were all, they didn't really have the Word of God that was capable of providing them the exact sense of Scripture because certain words were spelled different. To me, that is an extreme position, and I cannot go there. Okay? I just can't. But we're at time. We've got to quit. Appreciate your attention. We'll be back next week. Hopefully the boneheaded teacher won't forget the equipment. So...